Welcome back to the Narrative Monopoly Podcast. On today's episode, we have Antonio Garcia Martinez. If you don't know him, he is a true Renaissance man. He wrote an autobiography, Chaos Monkeys, which was a bestseller, that detailed going from UC Berkeley's PhD program to Goldman Sachs to starting a YC company, AdGrok, which he eventually sold, to going to Facebook's ad exchange team. And now he is the author of The Pull Request, which he gets into why he started that and what it's all about. Highly recommend you subscribe. But this is probably the fastest paced conversation that we have on Narrative Monopoly, and it does not disappoint. So without further ado, let's press play. All right, on today's podcast, we have Antonio Garcia Martinez. Most people who are going to listen to this are already going to know who you are. And doing my background on you, one thing I thought was interesting is you are listed in your Wikipedia page as an author primarily. So obviously, you're the author of Chaos Monkeys, worked at Facebook, worked on Wall Street, went through YC. Most people are familiar with this story, but for those who don't know you, is author the best way to describe you? How would you give the bio for Antonio?
Yeah, I guess author, writer, scribbler, occasional technologist, I guess. Yeah, it's, I think, a fair description.
Occasional technologist. Okay. We're going to start off this podcast a little bit different than we normally do, and I'm going to give you three quick questions before we get into the conversation piece. So first question, because I need the headline, is who is the smartest person you've ever met?
Smartest person I've ever met. Well, I mean, I think measuring human intelligence across along one dimension is a little bit tricky. But if by which you mean raw processing horsepower, people I've come into contact with that will probably rank up there would be people like... Probably the head of optimization at Facebook, who's not very well known, a guy named John Hegeman, who was probably the smartest guy that I met at Facebook. People like Patrick Collison of Stripe, who I've had a couple conversations with. He's very bright. Mark Andreessen, the VC, I think is also has intelligence along various dimensions, not just one. Paul Graham, to a certain extent, I think. I was a PhD dropout. And so back in my academic days, I met a bunch of people in like theoretical computer science or physics that from, you know, the pure quantitative intelligence are probably among the smartest people I met. But, that's kind of a slightly different dimension along which what you're asking.
Yeah. So, the underlying thesis of this podcast is that there's a narrative monopoly, and we'll get into the nuances of some of the tricks that that the media uses to get attention and advance an agenda. But I thought that was an interesting one because it's a very traditional media question to try and get you to name the number one person to get the headline. Obviously you can't, you can't narrow down that question to one person. So we're going to do it again once more. If you could invest in one company today, who would it be?
Invest in one company. My God, my investment decisions are so terrible. I don't know, because the right answer to that question is some small company that your listeners have never heard to, or a company they have heard of, but in their seed rate, in their seed round 6 years ago. Right. So, I'm not sure what to tell you there. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not a venture capitalist myself. I've only written a few angel checks and not very successfully at that.
Okay. Okay. So no answer on that one. Yeah. All right. Lastly here, is it Latinx or Latinx?
I'm still figuring that out. I don't know. I think it's Latinx. Either way, it's unpronounceable in Spanish. That's really the key thing.
So I asked that last question on purpose because I think my favorite thing that you've written is this piece on titled "That We Are No Longer a Serious People."
Right. Yeah.
And I think that Latinx is certainly a great example of that. And you wrote that around the botching of pulling out of Afghanistan. And it's just such a great counterexample of people arguing over this, where it's what, like a single digit percent of Hispanic Americans actually identify that way. So what is your overarching argument in We Are Not a Serious People?
Well, so that piece is mostly about the Afghanistan debacle, right? So I wrote that in the week after the Afghanistan pullout. And the point is, I'd have to revisit that one because that one's a few iterations back. I mean, there's one thing about writers, they kind of instantly forget about what they write about. At least I do. It's funny, people quote to me passages from Chaos Monkeys. I'm like, oh, that's very nice. I guess I wrote that. It's good that you reminded me of it. So yeah, in the I'm Not a Serious People thing, I mean, again, and I think, you know, I wrote that pretty early in the debacle. And I think it only got more and more the case. Let me remind myself actually what I wrote. Sorry.
I'll read you a little passage here. For those young enough to roll their eyes at what sound like tales of dragons and mermaids and other fantastical things, I assure you this country was once wholly embroiled in a titanic globe-spanning conflict called the Cold War. A Thucydian face-off with an implacable foe, diametrically opposed politics who didn't give a right fuck about pronouns or Me Too or white privilege, not that those concepts even existed at the time.
Right. So yeah, I guess I was basically poking fun at, you know, I hate the term elite because it sounds so elitist itself, but there's no better term for those who are kind of wrapped up in the current American power structure. And I guess the point here is that there's this obvious debacle there, you know, Western liberal capitalism, such as it is, encounters something completely outside of its realm of expertise or experience, such as the Taliban in Afghanistan, and their brains melt, right? And they just don't know how to deal with it. And, you know, there's one thing that sort of neoliberalism and capitalism, I sound like I write for, you know, some left-wing paper or something, but there's one thing they could sort of deliver is at least grappling with reality and making things happen, right? And the fact that the debacle happened so quickly, remember, it's now a little bit old news, but at the time, the crumbling of the Afghan government came as a huge shock, right? It just seemed to happen overnight and caught everybody unprepared. So that was basically the claim. And if you look back, and I know this is a little nostalgic, now I sound like a right-wing tread. If you go back to, I don't know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, there was real sort of external threats that our power elite sort of grappled with that were not just subject to media manipulation, right? The other thing I think I touched on, and I included some tweets, is that a lot of the people that are very prominent in either the current administration or the current Democratic Party grew incredibly silent when it came to the Afghanistan debacle and seemed to have nothing to say about it, right? This thing that was obviously the sort of preponderant issue of the day. So I think that's what I mean by fundamental unseriousness. There's a certain thought among, again, I'm using the term loosely, elites, that reality is kind of optional, right? And that we all choose. And this is the sort of theory of Bruno Massais, who wrote this book, you know, about how Americans are choosing to disappear into an illusory reality. And of course, the reality is that, you know, reality bites back occasionally in the form of the Taliban, say, you know, a seventh century religious thinking suddenly showed up on 21st century, you know, liberal capitalism's doorstep, and we didn't know what to do. And again, I think that's fundamentally unserious, particularly when you consider that, you know, this isn't just some status game. There's real outcomes to this, right? After I wrote my piece, there was this business of this drone strike that the New York Times actually did a very good report on, in which it turns out an entire family was wiped out, including something like seven children. There's an actual cost to these mistakes, right? It's not just like a Twitter dump.
And the guy that they killed was one of ours. He was an Afghan national who worked for us.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I remember reading beginning to end the coverage at the time. The details were still a little unclear. I wasn't aware that he was actually in the employ of Americans, but it was obviously a complete screw up, the sort of thing that would get, you know, cause ministers to resign in a normal democracy, right? Basically nothing happened. And again, there's just zero accountability to what are obvious complete screw ups. And so that's what I mean by unseriousness, that we have deadly serious problems to deal with, and we have an unserious elite dealing with it.
Why do you think there is no accountability?
Because I think fundamentally I think the US is only a very weak democracy, right? In some sense, again, if this happened in, I think, a typical parliamentary democracy, some scandal in which civilians were just, you would have at least the Minister of Defense or something resign. And if it got bad enough, you might, you know, there might be a no confidence vote and the entire government would fall and be replaced and there'd be an election. But the US, I mean, the democracy doesn't work that way. You don't have no confidence votes. And two, I think there's just, I think power elites have been insulated from the outcomes of their policies for a very long time. And you can find many examples of it. You don't have to go as far afield as Afghanistan. You can look in San Francisco, right? San Francisco in my opinion, is in the middle of an urban crisis along many dimensions, from homelessness to crime to the school system. There's just many things that are breaking, right? And there hasn't been some restack of power. A mayor hasn't resigned. There has been a recall vote for the school board finally. So there is some measure of accountability, but that's only because we have a recall mechanism in California. And if you get enough signatures, you can sort of do something. But at the national level, I mean, there is no such recall mechanism, right? Other than the presidential elections themselves.
I actually remember I deleted Clubhouse from my phone. But I remember a few months ago when Mayor London Breed was asked a question in a Clubhouse room about San Francisco, about the housing. And her answer was entirely about climate change and what they could do, like make the buildings green. And anyone, I used to live in San Francisco, anyone that has lived there knows that, you know, the housing crisis is absolutely a real thing. And anyone who is basically below a net worth of $1 million is just pretty much SOL. And to live anywhere near there. And so, and then you contrast that with the impact that San Francisco housing could have on global carbon emissions, which is right. it's completely trivial.
I think a lot of these elites and politicians have always sort of, you know, tried to sort of deflect blame, right? Like this is hardly new, but I think what you're highlighting is the consistency of people pointing to some progressive cause that is sort of this hot button issue that will get traction on Twitter and wherever else, and pointing to that, like, again, climate change, like there's a housing problem. Like you're the mayor of a city, right? You're not going to save the world. Sorry, I hate to break it to you, right? Your problem is the rampant homelessness, the rising cost of housing, all the things that your constituents are worried about, right? Not solving the global climate crisis or whatever. Which, as you highlight, San Francisco would have minimal impact on in any way, shape, or form. But it's weird that we've gotten to a certain political point. And this is true on the left and on the right, by the way, but we're talking about a blue city, so it's the left. But there's always this hot button issue that has some sort of transcendent religious importance, whether it be wokeness, whether it be climate change, that you can just invoke, and that just trumps the entire, that just takes all the air out of the room, right? And you can't just do the boring business of how do we fix the fact that a one bedroom costs $1 million in San Francisco? Because no one actually wants to govern and solve real problems because it's unsexy and hard and difficult and dangerous. So I think that's part of it. And again, I don't know how we got here, but I think if there's one little epitaph you would have on this entire age, it would be elite failure, right? The failure of elites, both right and left, but again, we're talking about left-wing cities, the failure to actually live up to their obligations to, you know, a democratic society.
Well, I do think, you know, you mentioned that you barely remember that piece. I thought that piece, I mean, that encapsulates what I see as the biggest problem in society with our elites is that lack of seriousness. And it's entirely across the board. Now, obviously, so Martin Gurry is a common friend, put us in touch, get you on this podcast. So thanks, Martin. And, you know, the thing that he, In his thesis, he says, you know, I'm not a prophet, I'm not a fortune teller, and so I would actually throw it on you of, you know, how do we get out of this? And you mentioned the accountability piece, like what is maybe it's a choke point of accountability, maybe it's the fact that the media does not actually serve in the quote unquote watchdog role that they say they do. Maybe it is the structure of democracy. I mean, in the United States, I'm also a fan of systems level reforms rather than election to election. So where do you see the choke point that could solve this problem?
There's a bunch of it, right? There's a lot of political partisanship in the United States. There's always been, right? I mean, there was never I think it's worse now than in the past, but there's never been this era of, you know, brilliant right. bipartisan collaboration. I mean, I interviewed Chris Rufo, and, you know, he cited various political science theories around in a, you know, first past the post two-party system, you're always going to end up in this sort of ideological deadlock in which the parties actually assume positions that get them literally 50.1% or nothing more, such every election knows. So I think that's probably part of it. I think Trump just was like a nuclear bomb thrown into the American political consciousness. And, you know, the needs to fight the perceived threats of this budding fascist dictatorship called Trump meant that truth had to go a little bit out the window, and everyone that was a documenter of reality had to become an activist about reality, right? And they felt morally justified in doing so. And again, I think, you know, often extreme times call for extreme measures, right? I mean, if you look back, Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. There was the Sedition Acts in World War One. I mean, this government has done, and other governments have done extreme stuff in exceptional times. But you only do that by doing a real trade-off against the cost and the risks of invoking exceptional measures, right? And I just question if this sort of new breed of partisanship and this business of like never actually questioning the current administration because the alternative could be worse. I wonder if the long-term effects of that are actually worse than the solution it purports to be.
Let's zoom out for a second. So what has gotten you tapped into kind of the popular debates of the day here with, you started the Poll Request podcast on Call-In. You've been writing a lot more. What is kind of the next chapter for you that people can look out for? Because it seems like it's talking about popular issues and weighing in and becoming a real voice in this arena.
Yeah, I mean, the pull request, as the name implies, for those who aren't familiar with a pull request is a technical term in software development. And when you develop code, you have a system which is called version control, specifically Git. And when you're writing code, you issue a pull request that says, you tell the main code base or the main developers, hey, pull from me and ingest some of my code, right? So the thought here was to take a lot of the tech thinking of technology, right? I mean, for a while, I pissed away several years of my time at war with tech journalism, kind of futilely, in my opinion. And I think, there's a real...
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, this whole Facebook, media story, which is still ongoing, it's like so stultifyingly boring. I can't believe people are still jazzed up about it, but whatever. That whole thing started obviously with the Trump election in 2016. Right? I mean, there was a little bit of anti-Facebook animus before that, but Facebook becoming the scapegoat for every ill that the internet has broadly caused, and two, obviously the vehicle for Russian disinformation, manipulation, every evil in the world that you want to chalk up to whatever, that that's been going since 2016. And for a while I thought, in my naive way, I'm going to fix this, or I'm going to write a thing that changes perceptions. And anyhow, I've given up on that naive delusion, but the seed of what I wanted to do was to kind of, again, change the narrative, speaking of narrative monopoly, in which, it'd be technologists writing about technology itself, right? Which I think I'm not the only one, obviously. So A16Z, Andreessen Horowitz, launched its own sort of media arm. And again, I think the idea there is very similar, which is to say, why do we need these journalist middlemen? You don't need them for distribution, right? Someone with a high follower account with a popular Substack can get as much or more distribution as some random reporter at Bloomberg or Vox or whatever. Why do we need these people? They're clearly not interpreting. I do think there is a weirdness around tech that needs to be translated to the normal world. That's a real challenge. And I think it's just writing nerdy stuff that just doesn't appeal to the average person, I think, is a mistake. But it's not clear that the journalists are serving as correct cultural translators either, right? And so again, why talk to them, right? And again, obviously, this is not a unique realization. I think lots of people in tech are very loudly anti-tech now online, and they don't care anymore. They don't need to placate. Oh, it's like, oh, well, what is the New York Times going to think? Well, kind of who cares, really? I mean, if you're in certain businesses or certain industries, maybe it matters. But if you're in a hardcore tech business, it doesn't matter, right? And arguably, all this Facebook quote-unquote backlash hasn't mattered to Facebook either. Look at their usage curve or their revenue graph. Point to me on that curve when the backlash started. You couldn't tell, right? And so a lot of this is basically just a chase after wind on Twitter. Like there's not a lot of reality to it. But in any case, I do think narratives and stories are important for all that said. And so I think writing the story of technologists is a different view. Of course, you're quoting a piece on Afghanistan. What does that have to do with technology? Good question. It doesn't. And so I think it's expanded a little bit. And instead of being technologists talking about technology, it's the technocentric point of view on everything. And it's not even tech-centered. I think it's just, I don't know what you want to call it, but to the extent there's a catch-all there, it's like people in tech who are politically agnostic, who aren't beholden to the East Coast elite media establishment and kind of go their own way, whatever that means, right? And there's a lot of people like this, obviously, I'm not unique. But whatever that is, that's the kind of view I want to project. And I think, I don't know, the Substack's doing pretty well. There's a level of engagement. I think people want that. I think people are tired of the traditional tech journalist narrative. It really actually isn't appealing to most people.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that you have people writing on specific topics that they know nothing about, right?
Right. That's the problem. And it's a little unfair to say, oh, you can't write about X unless you're an expert in X, because then literally there's no process.
I'll give you an example. I don't have many Twitter followers, so didn't get much traction, but I tweeted out, you know, how many reporters who have written stories on Bitcoin have read the white paper? It's only like 10 pages long.
Right. Well, but it's fairly technical. So yeah, but yeah, I think that's
the
right.
End. The end of it. It's technical. Yeah. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not impossible. The thing is, I mean, there are journalists who are pretty good at what they do. I mean, I could cite names of people who I think have a beat and understand it well. And again, the key thing, and this is what I tried to do in my book, for example, which I think is valuable. And people who dismiss this, I think, are being a little delusional. You know, the ability to translate what is an esoteric, very insidery field to the average, you know, relatively intelligent, educated, interested person, like that's a real challenge. It's not as easy as it looks. And in tech, it's typically not done well, though there are exceptions. And so I think I agree with you that yes, most journalists have never spent a day inside a tech company. They don't know what they're talking about, by and large. That said, there are some who do manage to get there. That function, even if the current crew isn't doing it well, needs to exist. And so I think, you know, techies often say, well, if you don't like this app, build your own. Okay, well, if you don't like this journalism, build your own, right? And tell your own story, because the story needs to be told, right? Like we're seeing, for example, in terms of the Facebook whistleblower thing, which is a whole other thread. But I think there's a real delta there between the way that Facebook looks at the world, or tech more broadly, and the way that people in congressional testimony hearing rooms in Washington look at the world, right? And at some point, right, like tech is very powerful. If you look at the top five companies, they're all tech companies by market cap and all that. But still, we live in a world in which tech does not run the world, although maybe it feels that way. And if you can't convey your message to the outside world, or they just don't get you, then that messaging will be left to people who are hostile to you, like many media people are. And so, again, I think technologists need to step up a little bit. And that's what I hope to do in my naive way with pull request.
Now, the one piece that you mentioned was that, you know, you felt that it was kind of a lost cause to fight against the prevailing narrative around Facebook and other tech companies.
Yep.
That totally proves, not to be like, I actually never like plug the narrative monopoly on the narrative monopoly here, but that is what it is, because right. The fact that, you know, because the second statement that you said after that was we can build our own distribution. But the problem with just building distribution when measured in just page views and people received is it's not narrative distribution. Narrative distribution is this collective mind share that, you know, all of the people who kind of like set the agenda, because I still think the media by and large does set the agenda.
Right.
If they're not buying into what you're saying, even if you have a ton of distribution, it's really hard to break through, because the consumer is basically like they're going down a Plinko board and they're getting to the bottom, and it's always going to be that prevailing narrative.
Well, right? Yeah, yes and no. I think what you're talking about is elite distribution, right? Elite messaging. The elite audience is what you're talking about, right? Because, I mean, again, if I interviewed Ben Shapiro a couple weeks ago, right? And whatever you think of his politics, he's been very successful at building a sort of alternate media universe, right? He totally dominates on Facebook. He gets a huge number of impressions. He's got this whole Daily Wire right. thing going. So he has created, I mean, it's hard to, you know, he didn't bring it up, but I, you know, I don't, speaking as him here with my little Ben Shapiro doll, right? I don't think he'd say, oh, well, I'm, you know, I'm not reaching my audience. I mean, he is, and he's arguably reaching a much bigger audience than Chris Hayes at MSNBC or whatever, right? That said, is he reaching the audience you know, the FTC in DC? Is he reaching the audience at Harvard? No, he's not, right?
That's actually not really what I'm referring to. I'm okay. Referring to the fact that, you know, I would argue the quote unquote crisis at the border, when it got a ton of attention, and I think right. like 2017, was an order of magnitude less than what's happening right now. And yet you hear absolutely nothing about what's happening right
now. That's not totally true. Again, I sound like I'm some sort of Ben Shapiro stan when I'm not, but like Daily Wire is writing daily pieces about it. And I don't know what their engagement stats are, but I'm sure they're probably huge on Facebook. So again, it's a question of representing. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so you're saying that basically it's these different information streams and...
Yeah. I mean, you see the collision in real time. Look at, again, I try not to take sides in the culture war debate, but I'm citing kind of the meta point about it. Look at the CRT debate, right? And you've got one thread in that CRT is either good or not objectionable and we should teach it. And the parents who are objecting to it are actually potentially domestic terrorists or otherwise kind of dangerous elements of society. And you've got another one in which CRT is horribly un-American and it's a patriotic thing to object to it. I think both of those messages are getting out. I think they're getting out to very different sets of people, right? But again, it's it's definitely one message that's in the elite precincts of society, but I wouldn't say that that's the only one that's getting. I mean, if that were true, then why are we freaking out over the internet, right? The internet's only dangerous if the proles are organizing and saying things that the elites don't want them to say, right? That's why the printing press was dangerous, because after Gutenberg, 50 years after Gutenberg, every city in Germany had a printing press and it was pumping out pamphlets like crazy, right? So it can't be the case that what you're claiming, right, is that it's not the case that the message isn't getting out. The problem is that the message is getting out, right? In fact, all this pushing of Facebook to content moderation is them trying to say, let's shut down the fact that they're getting too much distribution. That is the challenge. Now, of course, you might be posed the question, a lot of people think this, and I tend to believe it as well, that if it's not elite distribution, it doesn't matter, right? Like maybe it is this sort of like media version of a street protest, like this prole rebellion, but at the end of the day, that's just not important. It's what you know Congress does. It's what Harvard does. It's what elite, Google, Facebook, whatever companies do. You might be right. I'd almost agree with you there. But that is the face off. And I ask myself the same question. I don't know. Is it true that elite media only matters? Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. I mean, obviously, I'm spending time on my Substack, which is not an elite publication. Although I like to think a lot of my audience members maybe are disaffected elites. But I don't know. I think that is one of the preeminent challenges of our time, I think.
I would say the pull request probably is, but yeah. I do like that remix on the narrative monopoly and pushing it back on it, because I do think that's a great point. I would say that the question then becomes downstream, what actions are being taken as a result of that media information stream, right? So do the people who are elites have higher leverage in society to act upon that information? So if that information that they're acting on comes with a multiple of, let's say, the penny press, to fast forward from just the normal printing press, then wouldn't that be more valuable in terms of monopolizing narrative?
Wait, sorry, restate the question. I didn't quite get it. Your comment about the penny press.
So if you were just printing for the masses, so like, right, let's say that the distribution on Facebook is analogous to the penny press,
right.
Compared to elite distribution, right. If the people who are getting the elite distribution have more ability to act upon that information, then that information would consequently become higher value. Does that
yeah, make yeah, sense? Right. I mean, that's the right. I mean, that's the whole theory. That's the whole dissenting theory I just said, right? Which is elite distribution matters, right? Because only what Apple HR does and what Harvard's admissions office does matters. And I have lots of friends who believe that, and I'm kind of sympathetic to the view, yes. But again, the question is, how much do you think this rebellion, whatever this is, right, the alternative media outlets, is it going to rise to the level of a reformation, right? Again, everyone cites the example of the printing press, which I know it's a little cliche, but it's actually a pretty good analogy. The more you read about the printing press history, and I've read quite a bit, it's amazing. It's stunning the number of analogies between now and then. And again, then, you could have said the same thing in 1520, that it's only what's going on in the scriptoria that matters and what the Catholic hierarchy thinks. All these rabble-rousing little pamphlets being printed won't mean anything. Of course, fast forward 100 years, Europe was seized by one of the most violent war it had seen to date, and things had clearly changed in a big way. And so I think the uncertainty now is like, I don't know, which way is it going to go? Are we actually going to face a real reformation where elites are challenged? Like everyone tweets the same damn tweets about like the tomato meter in Rotten Tomatoes or whatever,
right,
for like,
right, right.
Dave Chappelle and Fauci, which is like, critic score amazing, audience score sucks, or vice versa, right? And it usually goes in the ways that you sort of think. The Fauci thing, beloved by critics, bombed by regular readers, and the Chappelle stuff, mostly bombed by critics and seemingly loved by audience score. That's it. That's the Catholic Protestant battle right there, I would say, to use a printing press analogy. And I'm not sure who's going to win, right? Like, you'd think at some point, right, these companies are capitalists, right? If Dave Chappelle does well on Netflix and Netflix knows exactly how many people saw it to the end, then, and assuming they're a profit maximizing enterprise, and maybe they're not, then they're going to like, well, who cares? The fact that he might be politically offensive, which some people think that he is, but I don't know. It's like the whole thing is like, oh, go woke, go broke. But then why is everyone still going woke? Either they're totally irrational, right? And they're literally burning down their businesses for the sake of some ideology, or it's not as bad for business as critics like to think it is. I don't know. I think that's the weird time we're in, right? How woke will companies like Netflix, Google, and Facebook actually go when it comes time to make decisions about their actual products that are more than symbolic, right? I don't know.
Now, How do you feel about kind of this, the, you know, you have a finite amount of time, how much time you spend going back to the beginning of the conversation on a problem like figuring out how to get all of our people out of Afghanistan and that whole policy at broadly speaking versus, you know, something like, okay, CRT, it's like everyone's talking about, you know, woke politics. And it's like kind of just this like tinny thing that it feels like it's just, you know, the flavor of the day. And it's not like as serious as like an Afghanistan policy yet. You also don't want, you know, your kids to learn that America is like inherently a bad place and everything. And so it's like, how do you operate within this, you know, political sphere in terms of focusing your time on things that are, I'm not going to say they're a distraction, but in this analogy, like more or less a distraction versus like super.
Well, I mean, they're short term and they're long term. I think I'd quibble with saying that Afghanistan is more important than CRT. I mean,
reject the framing.
There's very little society does that's more important than educating the youth, right? And inculcating with them certain values and knowledge. And so over the long term, I mean, Afghanistan is a total debacle and human tragedy, but you know, it's got an economy probably 1/10 the size of Miami's GDP. I mean, right? In terms of long-term impact, I still think it's super important and obviously was embarrassing and tragic, everything, all the mistakes that happened, all the deaths that happened. To be clear, I'm not diminishing it, but if you're comparing that
can I swap out China? Yeah.
Sure. China's obvious. Well, okay, but that's we've gone up by many orders of magnitude now, right? In both in terms of scale of country and size and all the rest of it. But even then, I would say how you educate the American youth is as big a deal long term as foreign policy towards China. Absolutely, it is, and that's why people are freaked out about it. Why do people get so freaked out over CRT? It's because the stories and narratives. And this gets to another post I did about Judaism, which sounds unrelated, but it's somewhat related. Which is the stories we pass on to our children and the next generation are in fact the most important thing we do, right? And so that's why I think you're seeing all the drama that you're seeing around CRT.
Okay. So it's you reject the framing of single important or stack ranking these issues. And I mean,
you can walk and chew gum at the same time. Like it is true that attention is zero sum to some degree. So it's not completely the case that, oh, we can talk about 50 things at once as like top, you know, as front burner issues in the national dialogue. That's not true. Even though the federal government does, you know, a million things right behind the scenes. So there is a certain zero sum quality to media. I concede that, but yeah, I don't think there has to be the one. In fact, that's one aspect of the internet that I think is super corrosive. And well, there's many aspects of the internet that I think are intellectually corrosive, but one is that feeling of the eternal present, right? Like there's today's Twitter scandal, which you get very excited about, and tomorrow we utterly forget about it, onto the next scandal. And we live in this perpetual amnesiac sort of tizzy, and which I think the internet has helped create. And in that world, I agree with you. You have to pick like the one thing to talk about because there's just nothing else. But I don't know that that's actually the best way to manage society. Not that, of course, there's any way to regulate that into existence. You can't like turn off Twitter or whatever. But anyhow.
So back to your earlier analogy, I believe the 30 years war. Are we just in the early inning? Is this like the first inning? And we as humans, you know, we've been around for like 200,000 years, been, you know, developed humans for like 50,000, and, you know, modern society less than 5,000 years. So is this just like, oh, wait a second, we've had the internet for what, 30 years? And now, you know, to put that time scale and that into perspective, the time scale, like, are we just figuring it out right now and it's going to look totally different in 100 years? Like what's your take on that?
Well, yeah, as background to many of your listeners probably aren't familiar with the 30 years war, because it's one of these things that tends to get ignored in American historical education, but it was the big war that basically defined, it was the violent eruption that came after the Reformation, right? So the printing press was roughly in the 1450s and 60s. And by, there was a number, you know, Martin Luther was in the 1520s or teens or so. And then this really came to a head. And mind you, we're talking pretty long timescales, right? So it took about a century and a half to go between printing press and like the global conflagration that killed millions of people, right? But of course, things move slower then. But it took a long time for the printing press, for the full impact of the printing press to be seen, as indeed, even in our, you know, very fast, you know, internet speed age, I think it's gonna take a while for the internet to really reach its full thing. So, you know, people often say that we're like in a cold civil war right now. I think Noah Smith coined that term. I kind of like the term because it's kind of true. But I think, you know, one advantage potentially, right, getting the counter argument to my Afghanistan debacle piece, right, the unserious thing is that like, well, sure, it's unserious when you deal with reality. On the other hand, making certain things unreal might be an advantage, right? Like the fact that we don't have a civil war, right? Like everyone who thinks a civil war is going to happen, I think is catastrophizing. I mean, who knows? 100 years from now, who knows? But right now, it's just not going to happen, because whatever that urge is sublimated. It's not by, you know, the North Carolina, you know, National Guard, you know, shelling a federal fort like the Civil War started, right? It's Twitter wars and virtual conflict that doesn't really end up in anything, right? And, you know, cancellation, as bad as it is still better than execution, right? And so it's this very soft battle and this soft dictatorship, which it still sucks, right? But I just don't see that level of violence erupting. But who knows? It's possible. I do think... That doesn't mean, of course, that things like a physical, you know, a political crack up won't happen, right? You're seeing political dysfunction as it is, between, you know, states. Everyone, the history of the United States has been some political faction trying to use some mechanism of the federal government to impose its interpretation of the Constitution on the other, right? And that has been 200 years of American history in one form or another, whether that be the Supreme Court, the US Army, whatever. And we're seeing that now, right? People, the whole CRT fight is going to be taken to the federal level, and the federal government's either going to impose it or reject, and then states are going to reject it. Same thing with immigration policy, sanctuary cities, same thing around abortion in Texas, right? We have these almost religious schisms that play out in our political culture, right? And they play out by the mechanisms we have at our disposal. I suppose, yeah, and you'd have to fear violence if those mechanisms broke down, right? Then maybe. But again, I feel, for better or worse, I think we're living in kind of a soft civil war situation with soft depression.
Yeah, I do think what gets lost around the Civil War commentary is that the northern and southern economies were more or less decoupled and actually almost at odds with each other in terms of federal policy, specifically tariffs. So that actually, I feel like, drove a lot of the animus before the war. And right now, I mean, the United States is very much an integrated economy across states.
But even more than the economy, right? It's like, it goes back to Dan Savage's piece in 2004, whatever it was, about blue states and red states, right? There aren't really blue states and red states, right? There's blue cities. There's an archipelago of blue cities and a red sea. That's what the U.S. Right. actually looks like. And I'm sitting in one of the Blue Islands right now. I'm in Nevada, but you know, I go 2 miles that way, I'm in the Red Sea again. I drive 3 hours, I'm in San Francisco. And so the fact that there would actually be a geographically separated actual hot war, it's impossible. How would you fight it? What's going to happen, right? You know, the Reds in the Central Valley are going to invade San Francisco, and then what? Like, they don't control ports. They don't actually control a cohesive state government. How would secession even work, right? Anyhow, this is all ridiculous wargaming, but I think it'd be almost impossible to imagine such a scenario. I do think you could have things like political terrorism. If you look back in the 60s and 70s, you had lots of political terrorism of various flavors. And in fact, we haven't even gotten back to those highs. If you look back at the number of bombings per year in like the early 70s, it's shocking how many there were.
Isn't it like 1,000 or something?
It was several a day. Yeah. Just going on for a year or two. Some of them were like small time stuff, right? Like without any casualties or anything. But so I guess we've got a long way to go before we start testing like historical thresholds of violence in this country. But, you know, again, the flip side of that is like, well, the people are way more sensitized to violence and frankly, not as tough as they used to be. And so maybe they'll overreact to provocations more strongly. I don't know. Maybe so. Nobody knows what they're talking about, man. No one knows what's going on. That's one lesson I've learned from my trajectory through life. There's no secret room where all the competent people are sitting there making decisions. That room doesn't exist. I've been close to some of those rooms. The room doesn't exist.
Now, in terms of, so obviously, yeah, right, about the geographic piece, what I think is going to happen is that we might just see states get way more aggressive in terms of reject, like push the bounds of non-compliance in terms of, you know, the next Republican president, you know, you'll have California just straight up say like, we're not going to do this. And then it would not surprise me if something happens in the next couple of years with Biden and in Texas. And in fact, Texas, I think the governor just passed this law where it said, you know, it's illegal to comply with vaccine mandates for private companies, which is, I think, directly at odds. Right. Obviously, all this stuff just gets gummed up in the legal system. But because it takes so long in practice, you know, there's this ambiguity and people just, it's kind of like people don't realize we have this system where if you are a municipal or state leader, you can just put things into effect and then wait years for it to actually go through the legal system, and you have it right until that happens. So, I mean, do you think it would just break down by state lines like that?
Well, I mean, that's what I was hinting at earlier, right? I mean, you're already having these state rebellions around whether it be immigration policy in sanctuary cities or whether it be abortion in Texas. You have states that effectively say, we're going to use the federalism broadly, right, to resist the federal government. And
but I'm saying going so far as like actually not complying.
Right. Well, that's where the tensions, that's where the stakes get raised, right? That's where the Texas governor throws a bunch more chips in the pile and says, I call you and raise you, right? And then Biden on the other side of the table decides to raise or not, right? And we've been in this situation before. The desegregation of the schools in Alabama was Truman saying, we are sending in the 82nd Airborne and we will force you to comply. We will threaten a hot conflict if you do not comply with this. Yeah, I mean, if things get to that point, that's... we have a history of that. That's how it works.
Right. And then, you know, that's people, the history is lost, but each state, you know, Texas would possibly raise a militia to defend itself against the 82nd. In fact, actually 50% of all special operations soldiers come from the state of Texas.
I didn't know that. Wow. I'm not surprised, to be honest, but okay. Interesting.
There's actually a, so I just moved down here and learned some of this, but there's actually a, like a high school pipeline that no other state has.
Amazing. Texas is so I like Texas. I haven't spent a huge amount of time there, but I have lots of friends who live there, and it just amazes me the level of sort of independence that they have in terms of how they do things. And I'm tickled but not surprised that's true.
You know, even Austin, so I'm in Austin, and you know, I lived in DC and San Francisco, and I've had people, you know, say, oh, you're living in the most liberal part. It's like you're back in San Francisco. No, Austin is a totally different city than San Francisco in terms of the blue-red divide. I mean, because the people who are, let's just say like registered Democrats in Austin, they're still culturally conservative. That's the difference. Right. They don't put up with, you know, needles everywhere and stuff like that.
I'm not there. You would know better, but it does seem... I mean, the concern that all these red state people have when blue state people show up is that they bring their politics with them, right? If you look at every thread where somebody, sure, oh, I just moved to Texas, I'm like, well, don't vote like you did in California. I wonder how true that is. And if anything, it might go the other way, right? Because like, if you're probably selecting for the people who are, in fact, reddest in California if they're moving to Texas, right? It's not like the pinko commie is deciding to move to Texas, probably, right? I guess it does seem like, I guess Austin had this whole bust up about the homeless thing and the camping law and all this. And I guess they passed a law that basically banned camping on public streets, right? So I guess to your point, they were culturally conservative and it did not go the way of San Francisco. But I wonder how long that's going to last and if it's inevitable that the cities go the way of San Francisco.
There is a ballot initiative because the police budget got cut by 30%. Yeah, so they that's a pretty big one. But I will say the camping, which I reject the euphemism, but the homeless people in the streets, it's nowhere near as bad as San Francisco. Like, we're talking, you know, a tiny fraction. Right. It's like one place downtown and under a few bridges. But so I do think that you know, good governance is valued in terms of the information piece of this, though. So back to the printing press corollary. So you were saying that this plays out. So how does the, you know, obviously that led to a hot war. How does the information piece play into this in terms of the federalism divide, the divide between states from federalism?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's one of the things that obsesses me that I've talked about with Martin, actually. You know, the disconnect between the I think if you were to ask me, what's the biggest thing that happened in the past 300 or 400 years? I mean, there'd be a number of things, but one thing that I think is a little bit underrated, or at least not mentioned, is the decoupling of how information flows from how matter moves around, right? The fact that we've decoupled atoms and bits, right? Which I know might sound odd. And if you're younger, people are like, well, what do you mean? How is that crazy? But like, I'm older. I'm not that old. And I'm old enough to remember when like letters were was how most people communicated over long distances, because phone calls were expensive, right? Like, you literally wrote on a piece of paper, sent it. It got there 4 days later. You responded 4 days later, right? Like, the amount of information you could absorb. Like, if you read a magazine, I was raised in Miami. If you want to read the New York Times, you have to read like the physical paper that arrived either late or was printed locally or whatever. But it was a big deal, right? And so the amount of information that you could actually absorb from far away was relatively limited when, you know, before the modern internet, right? And what that creates is that again, humans are so good at taking a symbol, whether it be text or an image, and treating that thing as reality, right? Like you read about, I don't know, a crouching tiger in some adventure story and your pulse quickens as if you were standing in front of the tiger. It's very strange, right? No other animal would look at scribbles on a piece of paper and get a, and have a fucking adrenal response because there's a representation of a thing that is supposed to be dangerous to them. But humans do, right? They take the virtual for the real. And so given the human penchant for sort of symbolic understanding of the world, and given the fact that the zimbals just zoom around now faster than they ever have, you have a decoupling between what is your physical geo and the community they actually think of, right? So again, getting back to the whole blue state, red state thing not actually being true, you have blue cities in a sea of red, right? Like, what is it, how, like, get, or your, the question was like, how does federalism work in this world? I don't know, right? Because the reality is like, even in Austin, right, the sort of information stream that you're exposing yourself to is probably pretty elite and not that red statey actually. But you go out to, I don't know, out in the wilds of Harris County or out in the Hill Country or whatever, you've got people consuming whatever, Fox News, Ben Shapiro, whatever. You're given the gerrymandering in Texas, you're in the same congressional district. I've actually reported from Austin, so I know a little bit about local politics. You're actually in the same congressional district, right? You're in the same bizarre gerrymandered district.
Chip Roy is technically my congressman here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I covered that race that he won. Actually, I rode along his Joseph, what's his name, was his opponent that lost. In any case, yeah, I mean, how do you deal with a world in which your information dies from your identity, how you even perceive the world, like epistemically, what you consider to be truth is different than the guy 50 miles down the road with whom you, in theory, share a polity with. I think it's impossible to do, right? Because it's, I mean, I'm someone who was raised kind of in two worlds. I was raised in Miami. My parents are Cuban. I'm a Spanish citizen, but also American. You know, the Hispanic and the Anglo worlds kind of overlap. They're both kind of from the Western, but they're also very different, right? And so I've just seen how culture affects your perception of the world, right? And I think it's very difficult. I know multiculturalism is all the rage, but if you're talking true multiculturalism, like someone comes from a truly foreign culture, it's very difficult to achieve a level of political cooperation on it. Because again, you have fundamentally different values and narratives. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm pro classical liberalism of the civic nationalism mode and the constitution, all that. I think it's possible. That's one of the political miracles the United States pulled off, is actually enabling that, as opposed to Europe, where it's impossible. You can't, I mean, even the European Union, which is like a very weak union at best, is like stumbling because they can't quite manage it, right? So, but I think it's going to be hard. That to me is the crisis, right? Like, yeah, I mean, in short term, federalism, abortion, Texas, all that stuff. But long term, how do you maintain states that are defined by like a square on the map when nothing about that square's culture, politics, people, anything has anything to do with the cultural language of the people there, right? I just don't understand how politics work, which of course makes me sound like Balaji or somebody saying, oh, we're all going to live in decentralized charter cities or whatever, which I sounds like a cool idea, but I think we're a long way from that. But who knows, maybe we'll eventually, at the end of the day, Balaji might be right about everything. This is Balaji Srinivasan. If your listeners aren't familiar, he's this very opinionated guy online who's big into crypto, was early Coinbase and on and on and on. And he thinks democracy is on its last legs, but he always does. So.
No, that is the question. I think that we just hit the root of it, which is how does a system set up for mass deal with an information flow that's, because the backbone of it's really any polity, but the American Republic is information.
Right. Right. That's
So that's the question. You don't have it figured out. I don't have it figured out. But that is, I mean, I feel like that is the question. So here's the second part of that is, in a lot of these conversations, podcasts or what have you, it's always this framing of like, what should we do about it? And it's like, well, who's this we? You know, there's like independent market actors who are creating companies like Facebook, like Zuck, you know, just created Facebook. There was no like central organizing committee that said, okay, this is how we're going to deal with information on the internet. Obviously the government can come in, they can create regulations and choke points and whatever, but there is no we. So how... For listeners, Antonio's shaking his head here.
Yeah.
I feel like I have you at a loss for words.
Yeah. I mean, there is no solution. I mean, yeah, there is no solution to the extent that Facebook presents a problem around disinformation or whatever. And look, all this anti-vax stuff I find as annoying as anybody else. There's no regulatory, solution to it. I mean, to begin with, it's not clear to me the problem is even solvable, right? Like, I don't think it's necessarily a solvable technical problem. I think part of the problem, getting back to the point about like journalists never having worked inside tech, is that I worked there when it was, you know, smaller than it is now, but still at the billion user level of things. Like, people who have not like fired up a dashboard and seen every number is in billions, users, ad impressions, clicks, everything is at a scale that just boggles the mind, right? That even very smart, educated people, you just can't understand what it means to have 2.5 billion people showing up and clicking on shit every day. And to think that we're actually going to police either truth or politically deleterious speech or any of that at any scale that would pass the, oh my God, you know, the screenshot level, oh, look at this crazy thing that Facebook showed me. Facebook didn't show it to you. Somebody posted it and it got through the algorithm. Facebook is not showing that to you, right? But the fact that we're going to solve that problem, I think, is just impossible. It's never going to be solved. The AI isn't good enough and Facebook doesn't have enough people. I mean, if they had a million people, I understand that like the Chinese censoring system has employed literally hundreds of thousands or millions of people. If you're operating at the nation state level and employed a million people to police 330 American speech, maybe you could technically do it. Now I'm not saying we should, to be clear, but just as a technical problem, can you do it? I think it just can't be done. And so I'm not sure what we're talking about when we're thinking, oh, we're going to regulate it and they're just going to fix it. It's not going to get fixed. It's never going to get fixed, right? Correct. I mean, I think on the, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that's right. And so I would throw back, is like, how would you, instead of saying, okay, you know, like here's the solution that you come up with, that's soundbite or something, like how would you reframe it? How would you reframe this discussion?
I mean, you would reframe it with an eye to fixing it, right? You would presumably speak normatively, right? So like how should this work? I mean, let's go back a little bit. Let's take a historical counterpoint, right? Let's go back again to the analog era, which I'm just barely old enough to remember, right? Like I'm like one of the last of the bridge generation, right? How did people do it in the past? Well, there was mass market consensus, right? And more so than now, I would say, in that there was, you know, Walter Cronkite would finish his transmission. Not that I'm that old, I never saw Walter Cronkite live, but he would end his new thing saying, and that's the way it is, right? And that's it. And America accepted it. Walter Cronkite said the Vietnam War was going great. It was going great. And if he said he wasn't, and that's it. Lyndon Johnson lost the war, right? That was at the very much the national level. At the local level, there was way less control than there is now, actually, right? Some little newspaper in whatever, in the boonies, in wherever, Washington, Tennessee, where it could say whatever the hell it wanted and reflect a regional culture and regional elites that had nothing to do with New York, SF, LA, like at all, right? And again, it's, the US used to be a lot more fragmented. Like I went to a Midwestern school, state school, and a lot of people there, you know, they went to their local state school. They were very bright, motivated people. Like these people aren't idiots, but they didn't just go to San Francisco and live in a little dumpy one bedroom in the Mission. They like, no, I'm going to stay in this state and marry somebody from here and make my life here. And there's a local paper and local whatever. And that is decoupled from the mass market narrative. That's kind of gone, right? Like that. So that's how in the past, that's how that tension was resolved. Because we used to have all sorts of regional differences. I mean, politicians like Huey Long in Louisiana, this sort of demagogue, right, that would have had no place and would have been butchered by the current media elites, it was a thing in Louisiana for better or worse, right? So one way the crowd would say, well, go back to regionalism, go back to localism, right? Go back to local media. But again, that implies so much with it. That implies indeed elites, people who have, you know, an elite view of the world, who are, you know, running a paper in Spokane, Washington. Right? Like how many of those people are there? I don't know. I think going back to the past is not going to happen. And again, I just don't know what the solution is to decoupling information from where you are. On the other hand, let's be more positive about it. So up until relatively recently, I was living on these sort of isolated offshore islands in the Northwest called the San Juan Islands. And, you know, population, I don't know, 16 or 18,000.
It's like Orca Island?
Yeah, well, that's the one island I was on, but there's like 130 plus islands out there.
Heard this gorgeous.
It is gorgeous. It is very gorgeous. It's also very isolated. But yeah, it is gorgeous. And, you know, 18,000 people or so, they have two newspapers, actually. They have one printed on Orcas and one printed on San Juan, which is the bigger one. And it's full. It's full of high school news, local businesses, lots going on these islands. But that's because there is a local community, right? Because they, I mean, frankly, they're isolated. It's an hour and a half ferry to get to the mainland. You know, you're not, you know, you've got internet and stuff. You're not living in like the ass end of Alaska, but it feels like a closed community, right? And so you have local community life. So I think maybe you could have reboots of that pre-digital localism, but it would have to be very special cases, such as, say, Orcas, right? Where you have people with communities and families. But that isn't like necessarily a scalable solution, right? I mean, this sounds like the Burkean little platoons that he claimed would hold together right. life from the church and all the rest of it. And, you know, I'm a believer in that. Like, you know, if you read Tocqueville, right, like his biggest thing he took away from the American spirit was the notion of free association. Every American was a part of was the centroid of like a Venn diagram with like six circles in it, right? And that was the web that defined their life. And we don't have that anymore, right? Like, I'm in one circle. Well, I'm in a slightly strange situation, but back when I was a regular worker bee, I was in one circle, the company I work for, and that's it, whose little hoodie I wore. That's the end of it, right? There's no functional identity. So again, I think it's hard to go back to that localistic world in a world in which corporations are basically everything. The government is kind of there, but it's ineffectual. Religion is very much a side role. Labor unions are gone. Regional attachments are few and far between. How do you create a decentralized alternative to the narrative monopoly, to use your podcast name, in that world? I don't know. It takes a lot of institution building. I'm obviously kind of a negative pessimist, as you can tell. Those who are more positive about it are like, yeah, well, we'll just create new institutions, new Substacks, new podcasts, Colin, the social audio app that I'm on now, like all this stuff. Indeed, maybe that's how you create it. Mind you, all this new stuff is like in the spectacle, right? It's like, it's all online. We're not actually creating new school systems or new militaries or new university systems, right? It's very much one particular type of institution which exists in this weird techno spectacle. Like the institution that like runs schools in San Francisco is not getting rebooted, right? So I don't know. So again, that's the pessimist side of me coming out there.
No, I agree with Jeff Lewis, past guest on this podcast, his take, macro pessimist, micro optimist right now. So that's kind of where I fall on this stuff. I mean, I do think that, it's not even, when you talk about localities, it's not even just news media. I mean, why would you get to know your neighbors during COVID when you can just Zoom with or FaceTime with your friends from halfway? And that's not even just COVID, but I think that is absolutely a thing. People like don't get to know their neighbors as much as they probably used to. And I know so many people, it's like, I just don't know my neighbors. You know,
a pandemic is a unique crisis, right? I mean, you kind of want to avoid your neighbors because of contagion. I remember I lived through Hurricane Andrew, which many listeners don't remember, but it was like the Katrina before Katrina. It was kind of right before the internet era. So we don't have a lot of online stuff about it, but it completely wrecked South Florida, like wrecked. We lived in like a state of nature for 2 months. I mean, we had our houses and stuff, but like there was no infrastructure. It was just gone to shit. And, you know, we actually met our neighbors and there was like the whole neighborhood became this little hunter-gatherer tribe or something, in which we all knew each other, barbecued the food because it was rotting because there was no power. And so I think it depends on the crisis. But you are right that I think it's
in the
douche cubes. Yeah, I know the douche cubes. I know that I just moved out of.
Okay. Well, let's end on this, which is just going from first principles. You know, there's this Henry David Thoreau quote about the telegram when it got invented, and he was basically having the same conversation we might be having, where he was critiquing news just in terms of it becoming national. And the quote is, what does Texas have to do with anything going on in Maine? And what does Maine have to do with anything going on in Texas? And it kind of, when you think about it from first principles, why do I need to care about something that's going on in someone else's state that's like a small thing that really has absolutely no impact on me in any way, shape, or form? I mean, obviously there are some national news stories, but a lot of it really is like, here's this one thing that happened, you know, in this place. And so again, I don't think there's any solution or anything like that, but just broadly speaking, you know, thinking about the media from first principles, why are we, you know, consuming this never ending stream? Cause you talked about, how the political bombings in the 70s, right? Well, most people who don't have that historical context would tell you that today is as bad as it's ever been since the beginning.
It's not.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Exactly. I mean, you're right, the current media world basically takes like the min function, to use a computer science analogy, of like all the world's events and just presents that to you. And the input to that function is now the entire world's events, while in the past it would be somewhat limited because, yeah, a little piddly bombing in New York wouldn't even get covered in like some Florida paper because it wouldn't be important enough. Yeah, I mean, again, that's the triad result. It's like, well, you know what? We should go back to our Burkean little platoons and, you know, live on Orcas and don't read the New York Times and read the, whatever it was called, the Islander or whatever, one of the papers. And that's how humans should be, right? Like I think part of the reason why we're all going crazy is because we've all wired our nervous systems to every other human via these damn smartphones, right? Like that's clearly it. And we haven't developed, I mean, I don't know if it's physiological, but at least the cultural technology to grapple with that. Right. And I think, and again, to be slightly sympathetic to the cause of like regulating Facebook or whatever, the big knee-jerk reaction is that the fact that we can frictionlessly share to anybody and stay and share anything is super threatening to elites, obviously. But it is true. It is a source of instability. I mean, I always use this as a counter argument to the regulate Facebook newsfeed algorithm thing. Like look at WhatsApp, which is not super popular in the US, but it's like the way to message basically every other country in the world. And in India and Brazil, you had all sorts of political hijinks because of basically sharing on WhatsApp. And WhatsApp, if you've used it, it's like the simplest messaging app in the world. Like there's group messages and there's images and there's forwarding and like that's it. It's like basically Apple Messages or Google Hangouts. It's not much more sophisticated than that. And that's enough, right? Because there are people get in a group. There's always that one guy who's always injecting the memes into the meme pool who kind of pisses off people, but people also like. He causes a fight. He warps reality for everybody in the group. And then it drives you crazy because you're seeing notifications all day. No algorithms, Facebook not involved. Zuck is not putting his finger on the scale and everyone is still going crazy, right? That is the fundamental problem. Right. And unless we're launching some new Butlerian jihad, to drop a Dune reference, right, which is in Dune, there's this like pretense that the reason why they don't have good navigation or AI is because as a religion, they just abandoned machine learning at some point in this universe's timeline, which is why you still have cool knife fights and stuff, even though they have like interstellar travel. Right. And so unless we have some Butlerian jihad and basically that's it, we're just killing the internet and we're just focusing on other technologies. We have to deal with the world as it is, right? And that's why I think the conversation needs to move on. Regulating Facebook is not going to fix shit. All this talk is going to look ridiculous 50 years from now. Everyone's going to look like a fool, right? Or it's just going to be forgotten the same way that all the debates around if you rode too fast on a bicycle, your face would melt off because you're going faster than 20. You know, there was all these moral panics around bicycles as well. We need to start thinking about what comes next. How do we run a world in which anyone can talk to anyone? And sorry, you're not going to get to censor it really effectively. Like what does politics look like in that world? And I'm not sure because we've just subjected the political system that was raised in the world of pen and paper and letters to this massive shock. And it's kind of reeling and try to keeping itself alive as every institution does. And I think, I don't know what it is, but the world of the future 20, 30 years from now politically looks almost nothing like it is today. It's impossible.
Well, that's a big take. The Constitution was probably not, they did not anticipate the speed and velocity of information. So we'll see if that stands the test of time. Where can people find you?
Oh yeah, so I'm at thepullrequest.com is the Substack, at Antonio GM on Twitter, pretty frequent poster. I'm also spent a lot of time on an app called Callin, which is like a social audio app, kind of like Clubhouse, but I think a lot better actually. It's more like a podcasting thing, and I'm on there probably once or twice a week. That's about it.
Great. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, Antonio.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.